From WHQR Public Media, this is The Newsroom. I'm Ben Schachman. Thanks for joining us. We've got two very different but equally complicated issues to unpack on today's show. One of those issues is FERPA. That's the federal law that protects student privacy. Earlier this year, as my colleague Rachel Keith was investigating an attempt to ban the young adult novel Blended, New Hanover County Schools invoked FERPA to redact the parent's name from some key documents. This, we noted, was a distinct difference from the process of banning Stamped, where the schools turned over very similar documents, but without removing the parent's name. As we'll get into, there are varied interpretations of FERPA, and the debate between privacy and transparency goes well beyond book bans. Later on today's show, Rachel will join us to help explain more about this federal law and how it might sometimes be abused. But first, Kelly Kinoyer is here to help unpack our recent reporting about New Hanover Regional Medical Center, which was purchased from the county by Novant Health almost 5 years ago. Now, we've done a lot of reporting on NHRMC over the years, but last month we dropped one of our most in-depth pieces, 4,000 words, diving into the issues at the hospital, pulling from employee interviews and years of safety data.
Okay, for people who might be relatively new to this story, let's talk about how this started, with Novant buying the county-owned hospital.
Right, and that's a whole saga, and we could and maybe should do a whole other podcast on it. But the short version is officials felt that because New Hanover County couldn't really invest outside of county lines, the hospital couldn't grow enough to keep up, and it was facing kind of a fiscal cliff. The sale process was controversial, but at the end of the day, the hospital was at its peak in terms of value, and some major healthcare systems were making significant offers like Duke, Atrium, UNC Health, and Novant. Basically, if the county was going to sell, this was the time. It had the opportunity to make sure it went to the best possible steward for the hospital.
So the county went with Novant, which made some significant commitments. They paid $2 billion and promised to invest another $3 billion, but they also promised to deliver world-class healthcare.
Exactly, yeah. Some people fixated on the money, and it's hard to ignore $2 billion, the majority of which ended up in the endowment. That was a headline grabber, but some of the people who looked really seriously at the deal were encouraged by Novant's contractual promises to make sure that this was a really great hospital.
And that's why some folks are concerned about the current situation at Novant. You've had dozens of people message you, email you over the years.
That's true, yeah. But you do have to keep some perspective. There have been some shocking patient stories online about the hospital, and I would never disparage those experiences. But some of them happened because this is the major trauma center for the region. This is the main hospital. So the sickest people, the most badly injured people, they come here, and it doesn't always go well. Honestly, bad things happen at every hospital. And during COVID, things were tough pretty much everywhere. But it seems like other hospitals like Duke and UNC Health, they've rebounded better. And hospital staff I've talked to, doctors, nurses, assistants, and others, they've said, look, this isn't the worst hospital in the world, but we were promised it would be one of the best. Some of the people I talked to had been at the hospital for decades, so they both remember when things were better before Novant, but they also had hopes for things that they thought Novant could improve with all of its resources.
So what you're saying is that mistakes happen, but they seem to happen more often at Novant. And the numbers back that up. We'll get into it a little bit more in detail later, but there are two different organizations that rank hospitals. NHRMC has been on the decline, and doctors have told you in no uncertain terms that those lower rankings translate into more deaths and complications. People are dying at the hospital in preventable ways at higher numbers than they would be at a higher ranking hospital.
Right, and that's probably not the result of chance. So we're asking, are there systemic issues? Are there things that go wrong, not because of one person's mistake or random chance, but because of policy or staffing or investment issues at the hospital?
Okay, so let's get into some of the things you heard from longtime employees. Now, you spoke with these employees on the condition of anonymity. What were their concerns about going on the record?
Basically, they felt like Novant's the only game in town, and most of them don't have the resources to pack up and go to a new region if there was retaliation or if a promotion opportunity just sort of dried up. They all really wanted to talk about this, but they were all really concerned about speaking up.
And did you worry about relying on anonymous sources?
Absolutely, yeah. I think our newsroom always worries about stories that are based exclusively on anonymous sources. But we're asking the public to really trust us that we've vetted these employees and that they're the real deal. And some people will just scoff when they hear, according to anonymous sources. So we wanted to talk to a lot of people. We talked to 6 current and a dozen former employees, some of whom had taken leave for maternity or family reasons and didn't want to scuttle their chances of getting rehired. And of course, we pulled those hospital rankings to backstop this reporting.
Okay, so you told me you met with employees repeatedly and talked for hours each time. What did you hear? Were there any through lines?
Yeah, a big one was resources. Employees felt like Navant was cutting corners on things like supplies and janitorial services and staffing. One employee with 12 years of experience said, quote, they choose money and providers' needs over patients and nurses.
That is not what you want to hear about your hospital. Did they give any examples?
Oh, yeah. We heard concerns from employees about dirty rooms, patients left in dirty beds. There are also some overcrowding issues, and there are in some cases hospital beds in hallways that I heard aren't always clean.
Yeah, I think the worst one you told me was about this roach that had been laying dead on the floor for so long, the hospital staff named it.
That's right, yeah. R.I.P. Fred. Another story, which was a bit more graphic, was basically about a patient who had some kind of gastrointestinal issue, and an employee was checking on them and stepped into the bathroom and saw the sink had a significant amount of blood in it. They were concerned that the patient had been vomiting blood, but when they asked about it, the patient said basically, oh no, that was here when I got here.
Well, that's horrifying.
Yeah, that one stuck with me. We've seen other stories like this on social media, and we can't vet all of them, but hygiene and sanitation is something we hear about a lot. There were other issues about not having the right supplies, too. I heard stories about waiting to do things for patients because they had to wait to be resupplied with things like medical pads and IV connectors. More than once, I heard stories about breathing assistants being essentially jerry-rigged because they didn't have the right device.
Well, what does Navant say about this?
Okay, so I spoke to NHRMC's newest president, Lori Whalen. She's been with the hospital for 15 years, so she has some perspective and I think some legitimacy in the eyes of some employees. She said there's been some logistical bumps with supplies, but there's a new warehouse on 23rd Street in Wilmington that she says is helping to smooth things out. She also said that the hospital had recently brought on a new environmental services company, is a fancy way of saying janitorial services. Sodexo is the company. They've worked with the hospital for a long time to provide food services. Whalen noted that the company actually told them they had to staff up from around 150 employees to like 185. But she did acknowledge that transition is still kind of a work in progress.
And then there's the healthcare staffing. This has been an issue for a long time, right? Back in the summer of 2022, there was a lot of reporting about a woman who passed away waiting to be admitted to the emergency department, which seems to be the result of understaffing. After that, a federal agency basically put the hospital on notice.
That was basically rock bottom for Navant. The hospital just couldn't keep up with staffing needs and was spending two or three times more per hour on traveling nurses than it would on typical staff. It was an untenable situation. The Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, that's CMS, put the hospital in what's called immediate jeopardy, meaning it was at risk of losing federal contracts, which would effectively bankrupt the hospital. So the hospital put tens of millions of dollars into staffing, not just traveling nurses, but permanent positions, trying to recruit and retain staff. I think most employees I spoke with, even the ones who were really unhappy with the way things are right now, acknowledged that the summer of 2022 was way worse.
Okay, so things have improved, but there are still concerns with staffing, right?
There are, yeah. Not just numbers, but experience. I heard that there are not enough nurses and certified nurses' assistants, but also that the staff that's there is pretty green. I heard frequently that some of the staff, because they were trained during the pandemic, didn't have as much real-life experience with patients while they were in school.
Okay, so beyond nurses, are there issues with staffing for any other positions?
Yeah, I heard they need more patient sitters. Those are people who are there to monitor patients and help them with basic tasks like eating and moving around. And when you don't have sitters, then nurses' aides have to step in, which means they aren't helping nurses. So you can see there's a whole domino staffing effect.
You said Whalen was pretty transparent about these staffing challenges, right?
I think so, yeah. I shared a lot of the concerns I'd heard with her, and this is what she said.
I won't discredit anything our frontline staff feels or says, you know what I mean? And their perspective might, you know what I mean, might be part of a bigger context, but it's the perspective that they're seeing day in and day out. So absolutely won't discredit anything they have to say. I talked a lot about kind of nursing staffing and the things that we're doing and the positive improvements that we've seen with nurses in and of itself. Nurse aides continues to be a challenge.
She also said they're looking at new options, including the healthcare pipeline. That's a $22 million endowment grant to the public schools, CFCC and UNCW. It's designed to recruit students into nursing programs. But Whalen acknowledged that program is going to take some time to generate results.
Okay, so something we talked about in the newsroom is the workplace culture, the morale. That's really hard to quantify from the outside, but I think everyone knows morale can have an impact on the quality of work. And that's an issue you've heard about a whole lot.
It is, yeah, especially when you talk to people who were there before the sale. I mean, it's not like there weren't issues with staffing or pay or stress.
But there's a certain esprit de corps, right? You were telling me, like, during Hurricane Florence in 2018.
Yeah, exactly. This is something I hear a lot from longtime employees. The storm was, like, brutal on the hospital. All of the injuries and illnesses and births and deaths that you would usually have, plus injuries from the storm and then people dealing with digging out. And the whole county was cut off from the rest of the world and without power. I heard that there was issues with the generator. It was a nightmare.
But in spite of all of that, I've heard staff really pulled together during the hurricane and after.
Yeah, they really did. That's the point I think people are trying to make when they talk about this. I've heard tons of stories about heroic efforts from employees, and storm recovery was an enormous and emotional task, but I've heard people say it was their finest hour. That wasn't about money or benefits, employees have told me. It was really about a sense of ownership and responsibility to the patients or pride in their work. And that's what I hear is missing now. One employee told me, I'm not proud anymore.
So what happened?
Some of it is just the corporate culture, I think. Many employees told me that they felt like some of Novant's team-building workshops were cringeworthy or infantilizing. I heard one story about a training called Spark, as in, you know, show people your spark, that featured a motivational speaker and an inspirational video about a Wendy's employee who'd worked for the fast food company for like 20 years, always offering a smile and a warm greeting for customers.
Yeah, I can imagine nurses didn't appreciate that, having their 12-hour shifts of saving lives compared to making Frosties.
It went over like a lead balloon, yeah. Employees felt like management didn't understand their struggles. Another part of the culture issue is the traveling nurses.
Oh, I'm sure. No disrespect to traveling nurses, since they've uprooted their lives and they're working hard. But I have to imagine that working alongside someone making triple your salary when you've been there longer is a special kind of infuriating.
Yeah, I heard that a lot. There's also just a cultural shift with newer staff. I've heard them described as sort of underprepared and also in over their head. The reaction is kind of a false bravado where they're rejecting advice, and that's really eroded the culture of mentorship and mutual accountability that people used to really enjoy there. And, of course, there's been some high-profile leadership turnover. President Shelbourne Stevens was fired in summer of 2023, and his interim replacement left just months after that. Ernie Bovio took over at the end of 2023, but at the beginning of this year, a leadership restructuring shook things up again. Now, Whalen is president and Bovio oversees the coastal market. Novant has touted this as a better way to manage growth, but to staff, it just feels like more churn.
So Whalen, as you told me, has been at the hospital for a long time. What was her take on this cultural issue?
I think she was understanding, but she took kind of a long view of this as part of bringing NHRMC into the Novant system.
I'm not surprised that that's a sentiment that's felt by some. You know, the last 4 years, this team has been through an huge isn't even the right word, amount of change. From, you know, trying to integrate during a pandemic, right, and all of those things. And just taking two very different cultures to large organizations and trying to, you know, put them together has, not to mention you talked about, you know, some leadership turnover at the top level here locally. So I'm not surprised about that.
Whalen said NHRMC was going back to a management model that was used prior to the sale. It's one that gives staff more agency. She said this model basically got lost in the shuffle of the sale process, but she felt like bringing it back would really improve morale.
Okay, but there have been really substantive claims against Novant here. Did she push back on any of it?
Yeah, she did. Now, this is a little complicated, so let me explain the allegation first. A lot of staff said that cultural erosion included discouraging reporting mistakes or near misses. There's a system for these. Longtime employees call them verges, and more recently I've heard them called variance reports. Basically, employees told me they're discouraged from filing a variance report on doctors or from discussing a near miss in front of families. They told me one story about a radiologist missing a key indicator that caused a negative outcome for a patient. Staff members told me they were discouraged from filing an official report. One employee called this hush-hush, and another said there's just no checks and balances.
So what did Whalen say about it?
So she said there are actually a higher number of variance reports at NHRMC than other Novant hospitals.
I can tell you, when you look across the system, we always have and continue to have the highest reported in the entire Novant system at this facility. So maybe it's less than it was before, but I don't think so.
That's right.
And it's significantly higher. So there is a whole team and a whole process where, and we literally meet once a week to review any of those cases that need to be looked at from a perspective of saying, hey, is there a process that needs to be fixed?
And a note here, when she's talking about the highest number of reports, that's actually a good thing. A lot of the experts we spoke to said that a warning sign would be a hospital that's not reporting variances. Those near misses or minor mistakes that could have been way worse, if you don't catch those, talk about them with the team, then, you know, next time they could mean a serious injury or death.
Okay, let's dig into more data since we're on the topic. You reviewed several years of reports from CMS. That's the agency that put NHRMC on notice back in 2022. And from LeapFrog. That's a nonprofit that gives letter grades to thousands of hospitals across the country. So what did you find?
So the short version is the ratings have been trending down. CMS has downgraded NHRMC from 3 stars to 2, and LeapFrog downgraded the hospital from a B to a C. Now, over the last several years, Novant has repeatedly said that these ratings are based on older data and don't present a snapshot of current conditions. And that's true. And in particular, some of the metrics that make up these ratings pull from the data during that low point in the summer of 2022. But when you really drill down into the data, you can see how the trends are moving. So for some categories, like surgical site infections and other infections, Novant really has made some improvements. But other factors like nurse communication, staff responsiveness, or catheter-associated UTIs, that's a big one, have all gotten worse.
But if the data is a couple years old, is it fair to use that to look at what's happening right now?
So, no, not as a snapshot. But you can compare that data to the promises Novant was making at the time and see how that was working out. Take, for example, two of the most serious outcome measures. That's the death rate for surgical inpatients who have serious but treatable conditions. And there's also a composite safety and adverse event score. They've both trended down, placing NHRMC in the lower third or worse among LeapFrog-rated hospitals. Those measures do include data from like mid-2021 to mid-2023. So yes, that includes that terrible summer, but also the following year when Novant was putting millions of dollars into addressing staffing and other issues. So you'd expect the worst score to be from CMS and LeapFrog ratings that were pulled basically from the whole pandemic period. But if you compare that to the most recent data, it's even worse.
This is all a little bit wonky, but it's so important to note that these data points are actually people. People stuck in the hospital longer than they should have been because of complications, having more painful recoveries, and yes, some dying when they didn't have to.
Yeah, and it's worth noting that, again, the pandemic hit every hospital, but other North Carolina health systems seem to have done much better lately. Wake Med has earned A's for all three of its hospitals. Duke University has done well. UNC Health earned A's for three of its hospitals.
Okay, so how did Wayland respond to these scores?
I mean, in the past, Novant has been almost dismissive of CMS and LeapFrog scores. They once said that they were, quote, pleased with a B score. But I think Wayland was way more forthright.
I would say I won't make excuses or defend that score. I think it's not what we expect, and it's not what our community deserves. And I don't believe it's representative of our team we've got here. I can tell you that. And it's not the hospital that we are today. But I can't go back and change those scores. You know, there's nothing I can do to make that. And I think focusing my time and energy and our time and energy needs to be on today, tomorrow, and the next day to make sure that every patient that comes here has top exceptional care, we minimize risk, and we have them have a great experience when they're here.
So I give Waylon and Ernie Bovio credit for taking some more proactive measures. But I still had to ask why Novant had only taken these actions over the last year. Why not way earlier? And Waylon really didn't want to engage with that.
Like I said, can't and really don't want to focus or need to focus on the past. I'm all about what are we doing today and moving forward.
I pushed back on this a bit because while Wayland's only been president for a few months, she's been part of NHRMC for many years and was Novant's chief operating officer for 3 years before she was president of NHRMC.
I get that. I do have to ask. I mean, you were the COO. You know, you had to have heard someone say, this is bad and we should do something about it. And to hear that there have been important changes made in 2024 and not in 2022 is going to concern some people. So I don't want to like blindside you with that.
No, you're not blindsiding me. I'm well aware. So like I said, 2022 was when...
That was tough.
Tough. It came. Yeah. The other thing, and it's not an excuse, it's reality of taking two large organizations, $2 billion, and merging them and integrating them. And there's bumps along the way in that process. So there was a lot of things happening during that time. So it's not excuses, it's a reality of it. And it's just we're finally getting into that settled zone over this past year.
Sure.
In relation to, okay, who are we as a coastal region? what is the culture that we want, what are the expectations that we want, and how are we going to get there? So we've also had the opportunity with Ernie Bovio joining us and his leadership last January. So all of these things are sort of coalescing around that time frame. So that's why I'm really describing the past year and a half, mostly, yeah. If that makes sense.
I mean, it's great to hear that from her, sure, that things have gotten better recently. But what we have before us here is clear data-driven evidence that things were really bad in 2022 and 2023, and staff members saying that the changes she's pointing to haven't really amounted to much yet. Am I wrong?
No, I don't think so. And I put this to Waylon, and she acknowledged that until people see some of these scores changing, we're going to keep having these conversations. From my point of view, one thing that's important is that Novant is no longer saying these grades and ratings don't matter or that a B is good enough, and they're actually promising to improve.
But that is part of our vision, is we will be Leapfrog A, CMS 5-star, and I feel confident that we are going to do that. And I expect our team here, I expect our board, and I expect our community to hold us to that.
I think Waylon's genuinely committed to that. But I agree with her. The public needs to see results, because what I'm hearing from patients and staff right now isn't good, and the data is still trending the wrong way.
All right, but where's the county in all this? Don't they have some kind of right to push for better things from the hospital because of that contract with the sale?
Yeah, there is a line in the sale contract where Novant agrees to, quote, use reasonable best efforts to position and maintain the healthcare businesses in the top 10% nationally in patient satisfaction. So I've spoken with several of the county commissioners on background who share some of the concerns we've heard from the public. But the county's take seems to be that their legal language in the contract is kind of slippery. What's reasonable? I mean, right now, I don't think the county thinks it has a legal case. I've also heard rumblings that a community group could, in theory, sue. And there's been suggestions that Attorney General Jeff Jackson could look into it. But so far, those things haven't happened. But I can say, it does feel like something has to give here. We're coming up on 5 years in February, and I don't think our level of healthcare is where people thought it would be when we went through with the sale. Setting aside legal recourse or potential oversight, when I go out to the community, that's what I hear. People are disappointed.
Well, thanks for digging into this, Ben. And if people want to get into the nitty-gritty, they can read your tremendous 4,000-word story on the web at whqr.org.
Thanks, Kelly. All right. Well, we've got to take a quick break, but when we come back, my colleague Rachel Keith joins us to help unpack FERPA. That's the federal law protecting student privacy. I'm Ben Schachman. You're listening to The Newsroom. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Newsroom. I'm Ben Schachman. Thanks for staying with us. Earlier this year, my colleague Rachel Keith was following up on a tip that a parent had filed a formal request to ban the young adult novel Blended. While the parent had initially started the complaint process at the individual school level, they had escalated to requesting the book be removed across the district. So Rachel filed a public records request for the complaint documents. After some wrangling, the district agreed and turned them over, but redacted the parent's name. Now, notably, Rachel had been through the same process a couple of years ago with the banning of Stamped, and in that case, the name of the parent, Katie Gates, was not removed. As our reporting evolved, we got a series of tips that made it increasingly clear that the parent asking to ban Blended was board member Josie Barnhart. And when we asked her about it, she neither confirmed nor denied it, and we included that in our article. Given that it would have been very easy to say, no, it wasn't me, that led many people to assume it was Barnhart. And sure enough, a week after we published our article, she acknowledged as much. But Barnhart claimed that FERPA, the federal law protecting student privacy, had been violated by people who had, quote, leaked her name. And on social media, other people argued that our sources, or even us as reporters, had doxed Barnhart, meaning maliciously publishing personal information. And we'll get into all of that in a few minutes. And we'll have links on the show page to add more context. But first, we've got to unpack FERPA. So Rachel Keith is here to help us do that. Rachel, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
So we're here to talk about FERPA. What is FERPA?
FERPA is a federal law that was passed in 1974. And basically, it stands for the Federal Education Rights and Privacy Act. And this is the law that protects student information. And when we talk about that, those are records that are directly related to the student, such as grades, transcripts, class lists, course schedules, health records, financial information, and discipline files. So you and I, as reporters, those would be off limits for us if we were just talking about a student record. So again, that would not be disclosed under the federal law, which is FERPA.
Yeah. So for example, you know, as journalists, you know, if we get a tip that there was a big fight at one of the local high schools and we ask the school, you know, who started the fight? And they can tell us, well, you know, a student was disciplined. And we're like, who, which student? Like, what was their name? They can say, no, we're not going to tell you that. All right. So we are talking about FERPA for a specific reason, because this played kind of a major role in a recent piece of reporting you're doing. There's a lot more to say about it. We're going to get into sort of the history and the ambiguities around it. But how do we start talking in the newsroom about FERPA?
We started talking about FERPA because we covered the book removal process for about 9 months for Stamped Racism, Anti-Racism in You. So this was part of, you know, our reporting that we were doing on book removals in the school system. Well, we got a tip that there was another one coming, and it was on the book Blended. So then I requested the documentation for this book removal, and that's when we were finding out that the parent name was redacted or would be redacted.
And this was different than what you experienced when you requested the similar documents with the stamped banning process, where right from the jump, we got a trove of emails that showed the parent's name, and that was Katie Gates.
Yes, and actually in all of those documents, her student's name was blacked out, and that was standard for us, but the parent name was there, clear as day. So then that's why we were confused that why was Katie Gates' name there, but this parent had protection. So that's why we started looking into FERPA and what it says, and we were confused about the different interpretation.
Right. Now, like many federal laws, a law can start one place and sort of its scope and power can expand through interpretations by the courts. But I just want to go back to the origin of the law. This is James Buckley, senator from the great state of New York. This is sometimes called the Buckley Amendment. So what was sort of the origin of the law? What was this designed to do when it was first codified?
Yeah, in reporting that we saw when people were interviewing Buckley in about 2011, he was saying that he wrote the law to allow parents more accessibility to their own students' records. So sometimes parents were going to the schools and the schools weren't releasing those discipline files or other information that we do know that they have access to. So he wrote that in order to help parents get their information about their student.
Right, by sort of clarifying what information was permissible to release to who.
Correct.
So over the years, FERPA, like HIPAA, which is the law that protects patient privacy, has been interpreted in different cases. And I would say the vast majority of the time, the law is kind of invisible. Right. So because journalists aren't asking about every parent's communication with every teacher about every student.
No.
We're certainly not asking about the thousands of patients that come through New Hanover Regional Medical Center and what's their glucose levels. That's just not happening. So these laws exist, but a lot of the times they don't come up in our day-to-day reporting. But it did come up in this story. And that was because we got a tip that the parent in this case, who was pushing for Blended to be removed, was board member Josie Barnhart. And at this point, it had gone beyond sort of an individual request to, for example, not have this book be part of the curriculum, or in this case, not be given to the students specifically out of a classroom library. This was a school-wide ban that had already been sort of escalated towards a district-wide ban. And so our understanding of FERPA, in part based on Katie Gates and the process of banning Stamped, was that if it was a similar situation with a similar scope, i.e. removing a book from the whole district, that FERPA should work the same way and that we should see the parent's name, and we didn't.
That's right.
And so we had to, you know, sort of start asking some questions about why did the district think this was FERPA?
Why did they think that FERPA protected this name?
Yes, the district did switch law firms in between the stamped removal process and then the blended removal process. So there might have been some different interpretations, and that's what we were hearing, is that Norwood Blanchard is one of the lawyers for New Hanover County Schools. And when we first were putting this to him, why is this name going to be redacted? And let me say first that the district was not even going to give us any of the documentation. And I said, no, you would need to give this to us. But they said, fine, but we're going to redact the parent name. And then that's when we got into this. And then Norwood Blanchard said that this technically is part of a student educational record. I just said what some of those were, like grades or discipline files, but parental book complaints, it was in our interpretation and that our knowledge from the prior process that that would not be part of an educational record of the student. And yes, Katie Gates's student, her name was redacted, and that's fine. And that could have been done in this case, but it was not. And actually, in the original documentation for this, Josie's student was never mentioned at any point. So there was no redaction needed for that. And another component of Norwood's point of view is that if you identify the parent, then you identify the student. And that's called what's called personally identifiable information. And the district has used this before, understandably so, when we're talking about suspension rates with students under 10 in a certain school. So you could potentially identify who that kid was who got suspended because the numbers are so low. The same thing with subgroups on test scores. If you have fewer than 10 black students in a school, you know, you can't necessarily report out that test score for that subgroup because there's just not enough. And that's also for data reliability as well. So that's where we had heard the personally identifiable information come in, was with the suspension rates and these test scores, not necessarily book challenges.
Yeah. And one of the issues here is that if this was a situation where a parent emailed a teacher or administrator and was specifically talking about their student and something that they wanted different for their student, whether that was, you know, an IEP or a 504, like a student plan, or, hey, this book is in this classroom library and it makes my student feel uncomfortable, there might be an argument that, yeah, that's, if you identify that parent, you're clearly, there's a pretty good chance you're going to identify that kid. But if you take that logic a little bit further, what about parents who come to the call of the audience and say, hey, you know, I have a student in the district and I'm unhappy about this. Is that public commentary now, should that be redacted from the public record? It never has been.
Yes. Right? And another point is, if a parent is complaining about a district policy, then those are usually released. Those are released emails.
Exactly. So once you start talking about something that is broader than the specific situation with your student in the classroom, then that's where you, in our experience from looking at a lot of the things, and we're going to get into those other things, that's where you've gone beyond the bounds of FERPA.
Yeah, and even my last interview with Dr. Christopher Barnes, who is the superintendent of the school system, in our conversation, because he did overrule the decision of two school committees, I said, I just want you to know that this HQR would not be doing this story if this was just between a parent and the teacher about a curriculum item that they did not want to participate in. But it became part of our domain when it would affect all libraries or all classrooms in the district.
Yeah, and I think that gets to the allegation that we've seen that this was doxing. So if you're not familiar with the term, although I think most people are now, doxing is basically when you take information about a person and you publicize it, usually with a specific intent of making their life miserable. It's malicious intent. You're trying to hurt that person in some way. What's interesting is often that information is public. And I think part of the sort of confusion around doxing is that people don't understand how much of what they imagine their personal life is actually public. The number of people who I've spoken to who are very surprised that their address is a public record if they're a registered voter, which parties they...
if they own property.
If they own property, how much property tax they owe. I mean, there's a tremendous amount of information that is an actual public record. And then if you've engaged in social media at all, there is a lot about your life that is sort of in a gray area because there's some debate about how public is social media. But if you have an open Facebook account, that is, in some people's opinion, tantamount to just putting stuff into the public square. So when we are reporting on a story, often journalists will gather this information about a person. If they're an elected official, if they're appointed the head of a powerful institution, like a university or an endowment or something like that, we can go through their LinkedIn, we can go through their property records and see who is this person. And often we will include that information in our reporting because we want people to get a sense of who is this powerful person in charge, right? I don't think that fits the definition of doxing, but I think people have sort of weaponized the word doxing to be any information about a person that they don't want out there, even if our intent is to inform the public about a public official, not to pick a specific person. And the contrast to this would be, Rachel, if you or I picked a random person, right, John Smith from Ogden, and just put everything we could find about him from social media, from tax records, from voting records, and just put out a random article and just put this poor guy under a microscope for no reason other than to make his life a living hell, yeah, I think that would be doxing. Now, there are some laws that are emerging in various places to try and, you know, get some legislative teeth around this issue, especially when it comes to minors. And there's been some pushback from some free speech groups like FIRE and the ACLU. So we don't, it's an evolving conversation. But in this particular case, people who say that we doxed Josie Barnhart, I do think it's important to know, one, it's our sense that this should be a public record. And two, we never would have done this if it had been a single parent talking about just their kid. We have no interest. And we've made this case publicly elsewhere, but I think it's worth reiterating all that.
Yes. And I mean, on that same line of logic, did the district dox Katie Gates, or did Charlotte Mecklenburg schools, which we're going to get into in a moment, they are releasing the name of a parent who wanted the removal of Julian as a mermaid. So this was the logic that we were looking at.
Okay, well, we need to take one more quick break, and when we come back, we'll have more with Rachel Keith, looking at what some legal experts have told us about FERPA. I'm Ben Schachman. You're listening to The Newsroom. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Newsroom. I'm Ben Schachman. Thanks for staying with us. We've been talking about FERPA, that's the federal law that protects student privacy, and how it played a role in our reporting on parental complaints about books in New Hanover County schools. But we also wanted to get some other expert perspectives. We did look at how other school districts in North Carolina have handled this case, because certainly New Hanover County is not the only place where parents have had concerns about books in the schools. And this is not to make a moral judgment on whether or not those parents are right to want to remove those books. Under the law, they have that right. But once you go, again, beyond what's happening to your kid in that classroom and say, I don't want this book in the whole school, or I don't want this book in the whole district, a couple of other districts that we've looked at said, yeah, that's not protected.
Yes. I mean, New Hanover County Schools is a prime example. We have mixed interpretation here, and we actually know this through Pate McMichael. He's the director of the Open Government Coalition at Elon University. He teaches students media law. And each year, that's 90 years of the public records law has been in existence. So every year they pick a public record to request. This year they are working off of even our work that we worked with other state organizations on the efforts to remove books from the curriculum or the libraries. They're also looking at it too. They have requested information from all 134 school districts about how many requests have you gotten to remove books or curriculum items since 2020. And what Pate McMichael said is that Charlotte Mecklenburg, Randolph, and Pitt County Schools, they are releasing the parent names. They are redacting the student name, but we know who is trying to remove books in those school districts. But Burke and Sampson County Schools, they are redacting the name of the parent. So he is even in his own project seeing that there are mixed interpretations of this law.
But that said, he does kind of push back against the argument that we've seen Josie Barnhart and some of her supporters make, where she basically said that her privacy was destroyed and her children had their privacy destroyed as sort of collateral damage of all of this. And McMichael basically told you that he couldn't find that in state statute, that level of protection.
Are there examples out there where disclosing the name of a parent who's attempting to restrict materials from consideration has led to harm to student. I don't know of a single example. I think the people that are making this argument should provide those rather than go around accusing people of violating people's privacy. I mean, they need to be careful with their words because, you know, you don't have a right to not have your name disclosed when you choose to come forward and request to remove instructional materials. That there's nothing in the state law that says school systems need to restrict the names of who's making those requests. So, like, legally, where is their justification for not disclosing who's asking for the materials to be reconsidered? I can't find it anywhere.
Well, I wanted to know that, you know, Pete McMichael is not a lawyer by trade. He is an expert on public records. But you also talked to other attorneys about this issue just to get more perspective.
Yes, and they were happy to weigh in on this. But again, they made the caveat that they are not our attorneys, correct? But this is their understanding of FERPA because they use it every single day. And I first talked to Jonathan Gaston Falk. He's a staff attorney at the Student Press Law Center. And we wrote to him about this predicament, and he wrote, quote, "Based on the information you gave, I do not believe FERPA would apply. Such a complaint should not constitute an educational record under the Act. In fact, I would be alarmed if such a document, which has an effect on all children in the district, could be kept under lock and key because of FERPA."
Right, so that was one take on this. You also spoke with attorney Nubia Harris.
Yes, she actually specializes in education law and practices in North Carolina concerning families and their rights. And she said, quote, "It's my opinion that FERPA safeguards the privacy of student education records and that its confidentiality provisions do not typically extend to general parental communications about school policy unless the communications become part of a student's education records. Therefore, a parent's identity linked to a district-wide book removal request is generally not protected under FERPA." And she added that when a parent communicates with the district about curriculum or materials, they usually participate in civic discourse. These types of communications are typically subject to public records law rather than being protected by student privacy statutes, which is FERPA. And this is what Pate McMichael is saying. 100%, he told me on the record, this is not FERPA. This would be subject under state public records law. And he did say that the General Assembly could make it, if you send in a parent sends in a complaint, they could make that in the law protected, but they haven't done that as of now.
Right. So those are some perspectives from people who have some expertise in this field. But an attorney can only really give you their opinion. But that is not the same as saying this is covered by FERPA, because really only the courts can decide that. And so I think there's been, perhaps not nefariously, but it has just happened in the conversation on social media where people have had a little slippage from, you know, Norwood Blanchard saying this is protected by FERPA to saying as a fact, this was violated. This was a violation of federal law. Well, that's not true because none of us, unless we are a judge, have the ability to say that's what happened. So I think that's worth keeping in mind as you watch some of these debates unfold online.
Absolutely.
Okay, so let's move on to the other side of this argument, which is what if we went to court and we got this in front of a judge, or this happened somewhere else around the state and it set a precedent that yes, even a district-wide book removal ban, restriction request, whatever you want to call it, is protected under FERPA when it comes to the name of the parent that sort of set the ball rolling. Okay, what does that mean for things?
Yes, and I asked Pate McMichael about this and talked about what the state statute actually says right now. It's 115C-98, and it says, quote, "The local board at all times has sole authority and discretion to determine whether a challenge has merit and whether challenge materials should be retained or removed." So the last stop for book challenges is the school board. And he talked about how this would play out, that this challenge did in fact come from a board member.
In the case of North Carolina law, the board will make the final decision ultimately. So if that person didn't recuse themselves, right, let's say it went that far hypothetically, and the person making the request was also on the board deciding it, I don't think anybody would consider that a legitimate type of hearing, right? And you would have to recuse yourself. But how would the public know whether that was happening or not if the name is not disclosed?
I think another issue here is I think there's some value in knowing whether or not the person issuing the challenge is living in the county, has a student in the district. I think this is a concern that you would see shared on the left and right of the aisle. I mean, take campaign finance, right? We see people on both sides frustrated.
And actually, Pate McMichael said it's a little stretched to compare the two, but you could compare them.
I mean, I think the idea, the sentiment, right, beyond the law is just that people are as offended someone like George Soros might put money into a local election as the Koch brothers, right? On both sides, there's some frustration that these big financial institutions are sort of getting their hands in a local election. And also, you know, we've seen concerns when it comes to the schools that there are state and national advocacy groups that are kind of have a local sock puppet to push a certain agenda, conservative or progressive, but that they're not really coming from inside the community. I think those concerns are valid. I think at the local government level, you have a vested interest in knowing that people who are advocating for a policy, regardless of what that is, are coming from inside your community. And blacking out that name kind of takes away your ability to know that.
And we know with the past two book challenges, they did come homegrown from our own community, and the public knew that. And so, again, it's not the fear that it came out of someone out of D.C. or an operative that's based here out of D.C. We know who these people are.
Okay, so we've talked about some of the ways that FERPA was intended to be used. And again, like many federal laws, that has expanded. And that's sort of a function of the courts. A lot of this has to do with each case kind of changes the interpretation and adds a layer sometimes of power and scope to these laws. But at the same time, I think we've heard from plenty of people, including, you know, James Buckley, who authored the act, that FERPA has been pushed beyond, way beyond its initial intended use. And you spoke to an expert who kind of drove that point home.
Yeah, and I spoke to him in 2023, and I got permission to use it again. Mark Stenzel is a former Duke professor. He's doing his own company now around news information. But I asked him, I didn't understand why CFCC, our community college here, there were a lot of alumni emails coming in very upset about what was going on over the Marine Tech program. There were a lot of different changes in that program, and they were writing emails to voice their displeasure with what was going on. But the community college redacted those names. And I said, why'd you do this, FERPA? Well, I finally, at the time, I couldn't get the name unredacted in time for the report, and I was waiting a long time. Essentially, actually, when I referenced the Student Press Law Center, they helped me out and said, hey, this person is not a student anymore. Any communications that they send as an alum are not protected by FERPA.
Yeah, right. If I write an email to my alma mater of Rutgers, the State University of New Jersey, 20-some years after I graduate, yeah, that's a public record.
It's a public record. And actually, I also reached out to the Duke Law Clinic, and they said there's something in FERPA that says student directory information is not protected. So just because of the fact that a student goes to a school is not protected as well. So yes, CFCC kind of dug their heels in, but later unredacted the name. But I did get a small win in that case.
Yeah. And so from that 2023 reporting, this was Mark Stenzel's big takeaway.
FERPA is just about the most abused law in all of officialdom because it is used constantly as a shield against media inquiries that have anything to do with education. And just by having a student's name in something becomes an excuse not to provide the information. And the only way we can get past that is often taking institutions to court.
And because taking legal action can be prohibitively expensive for media outlets, a lot of the times that works and media outlets back down. Although it's certainly something we would consider if the story was important enough. It's something we considered in this case to get the name behind the, you know, attempt to ban Blended released. Although in the end, Josie Barnhart outed herself on social media. But it's an important part of the story is it's not just that media outlets can go to the courts to get an ultimate decision, it's that it can be quite expensive to do that. And sometimes that means they just don't follow the story.
Right.
All right. Well, for now, Rachel Keith, thank you for your reporting and thanks for being here.
Thank you.
All right. Well, that's just about all the time we have for this edition of The Newsroom. Thanks to Laurie Whalen, president of Novant NHRMC, for her time last month, and to my WHQR colleagues Kelly Knoyer and Rachel Keith for help with today's show, and program director Ken Campbell for technical assistance.
If you missed any part of today's show, you can find it at whqr.org or as a podcast, most places that you can find podcasts. Music for today's show came from If These Trees Could Talk and Blue Dot Sessions. If you have comments, concerns, or an idea for a future show, you can email us at newsroom@whqr.org. I'm Ben Schachman. Thanks for listening, and I hope you'll join us for the next edition of The Newsroom.